Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books on Higher Education podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ariadna Obregon. Today, I am delighted to be talking to Nicholas Dirks. Nick is the current president and CEO of the renowned New York Academy of Sciences, one of the oldest scientific organizations in the United States. His notable past appointments include serving as the 10th chancellor of the University of California, Berkeley, from 2013 to 2017, and as the executive vice president and dean of the Faculty for Arts and Sciences at Columbia University. In today's conversation, I will be interviewing Nick on his most recent book, City of Intellect, The Uses and Abuses of the University, published by Cambridge University Press. Drawing from his experiences of having belonged to the faculty, administrative, and presidential circles of the university, in City of Intellect, Nick offers his nuanced and comprehensive reflections on the solutions for the most pressing issues facing universities today, ranging from issues with free speech, interdisciplinary work, budgeting costs, internal politics, and the devaluing of the liberal arts. In a time where universities face fierce attacks from the political right and left and a distrust from the general public, Nick defends the role in society as key institutions that guard and create knowledge to understand the world at large and drive meaningful change. Nick argues for a reimagination of the university to ensure its survival and relevance in the years to come, positioning him as a visionary leader in a time where higher education needs it the most. Welcome to the podcast, Nick. Delighted to have you on.
I'm delighted to be here, Ariadna.
Yeah. So I just wanted to ask you, can you introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your professional background and, yeah, just introduce yourself to our listeners and how, you know, your experiences led to the writing of this book?
Well, first of all, thank you for that lovely introduction. And, you know, I'm really pleased to be here in this conversation with you. My own background as an academic, I studied the history and anthropology of India, of South Asia, and became interested in India really because of an early experience I had living there for a year. And I just became fascinated with so many different issues that allowed me both to spend a lot of time there, particularly when I was doing my dissertation research and in the early academic years of my career, but also to think more broadly about the kinds of social, political, and cultural issues that were raised around area studies in the U.S. context, which is to say, thinking in relationship to political events in the U.S. about, you know, both the legacy of British colonial rule in India, but also about the experience of, coming from a different place, studying a culture and a civilization, trying to engage with critical issues, but also trying to champion the importance of serious studies of Asia and other parts of the world in the U.S. Academy. So I got this kind of bidisciplinary training by virtue of the fact that I was in a history department studying primarily with an anthropologist. And I went on to have joint appointments. And in fact, when I had a 10-year period, which was one of the most happy and productive parts of my academic career at the University of Michigan, I worked with colleagues to create a joint PhD program in anthropology and history, in effect, to try to make available for other students the multidisciplinary kind of education I'd had myself. So, you know, the old expression, no good deed goes unpunished. I ended up because of that, because of the success of that program in Michigan, being invited to be chair of the Department of Anthropology at Columbia. I moved to New York. And then because of the success of building or rebuilding that department, I was asked by the then president of Columbia to become the dean and vice president of arts and sciences there. And so I hadn't really intended to move from my life as a professor and writer, researcher, teacher into academic administration, but I did so really in the first instance because I was interested in creating interdisciplinary opportunities for students. And then secondly, because I was given the opportunity to do some of the things I was doing in my home departments across a broader cross-section of the university. And I just found it incredibly interesting to learn more about other fields. When I was at Columbia, there were 29 departments that I was responsible for. So I worked with chairs of biology and chemistry, helped to build a new department in environmental studies, but also dealt with some of the crises that existed in older departments, like the Department of English, for that matter, the Department of Spanish and Portuguese Studies, which was going through a period of generational, crisis and renewal. But the point is that I just found it incredibly interesting intellectually to have these experiences. But I also learned more about the university as an institution. And I realized, of course, that, like all universities, Columbia was this incredibly successful institution, been around for a very long time, not as long, of course, as the great old universities in the UK that have been there since, for a millennium, virtually by now. But still, that universities had been among the most perdurant of institutions in the United States, existing longer than corporations or other kinds of institutions. At the same time that they were institutions that found it very difficult sometimes to change. And, my sense was always that this was a kind of paradox. On the one hand, that they could survive over long periods of time, but that they, in fact, resisted change, even though there were apparent reasons why these institutions should change more and change more quickly in order to, as it were, keep up with the times, if possible, even to keep ahead of the times. So I began to try to work to find strategies to, to preserve what was best about, of course, the old institution in terms of its commitments to learning, its the access it afforded to students to work with, terrific professors and to, have these kinds of transformational experiences that higher education involves, both at the undergraduate and graduate level. But at the same time, to be part of necessary changes in the institution. And I had gone to college during protests about Vietnam. So, I was also concerned about the relationship between the university and the political world outside. But in the spirit, as it were, of the first work I did in academic administration, that is to say, building a joint PhD program, I championed interdisciplinary studies. I worked very hard with colleagues at Columbia to diversify the faculty while I was dean. And I became very interested in the kind of globalization of the university, that is to say, the kinds of relationships that American universities were establishing with universities, or sometimes new universities, sometimes old universities, in other parts of the world, and including, you know, China, the Middle East, Singapore, India, et cetera. And it became clear to me that there were really important things that universities should do in a global context, because universities tend to be the most successful, in some sense, the most successful global institution. It's where, you know, students from all over the world, faculty from all over the world come, go, maintain connections, establish friendships, but also learn different ways of thinking about the world. So those were the kinds of areas that I really became engaged in when I was a dean. And then when I went on from Columbia to move to Berkeley to become its chancellor, I became, you know, especially focused indeed on those same kinds of questions, you know, how to make interdisciplinary undergraduate education more vital, how to keep the graduate program sort of, you know, developing with the times, how to use the global reputation of Berkeley to establish better international kinds of ties, and, you know, how to move the institution in a way to change thoughtfully, but nevertheless, you know, to change perhaps a little bit more aggressively in a world that was changing so quickly. So that's the kind of story. And of course, you know, that's the kind of idealized version of my career. Of course, you know, you engage in change, you engage in these kinds of moves from being a member of faculty to administration, and you learn that it's not quite as simple, that there are a lot of disagreements, there are crises that come up, there are challenges that, you know, are sometimes really vexing and difficult. And so, you know, I also realized there's a kind of drama to this life that certainly I had. And so when I stepped down and had some time, and then the pandemic came and gave me more time, I thought I really wanted to both write a kind of memoir of my experiences, not memoir of my personal experiences, but of my professional experiences, but also try to write about some of the major challenges that exist at the level of the university, certainly both in the private university and the public university context in the U.S., because I've been both in academic administration at Columbia and Berkeley, but also to think more broadly about some of the kinds of issues that are roiling on college campuses. And lo and behold, the book comes out and those controversies have just gotten more intense and more difficult, I think.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that introduction. That was wonderful. Very comprehensive. And I think, yeah, I think you're, I think you mentioned in your book that you're someone that does not, you know, you don't stay in your lane. You've been, you know, part of the faculty, you've been an administrator, you've been president, you know, you're someone that has experience with all these roles and sees, you know, value, and you understand all these different circles in universities. So yeah, thank you for that comprehensive introduction. I wonder if you could talk a bit more about this idea of interdisciplinary work, because it's something you mentioned throughout your book, you know, how important it is to foster this. And I wonder if you could speak more about that, because I think it's ties into one of the ways that we can reimagine universities, you know, foster interdisciplinary work to address our present challenges, you know, and all the, you know, AI, for instance, and how we, you know, the arts and sciences need to come together and we need to do more interdisciplinary work. But also it relates to this idea of how it can, you know, make faculty, you know, if they were to have different appointments at different departments and see the value in interdisciplinary work, they would, I don't know, not... not stay, not feel that tied to their own department and to their own, because there's this idea, isn't it, that faculty just say, oh, the department is my identity and I don't want to really collaborate with anyone else. And there's this kind of vicious attitude towards other departments and there's no collaboration. So yeah, I wonder if you could talk a bit more about the idea of interdisciplinary work and how it's, I guess, key in how we can reimagine universities.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. Well, you know, I think a couple of things are relevant to an answer to your query, and one is that, you know, many of the disciplines that we continue to have in universities, then that continue to kind of provide the basic structure of university governance, were in fact created in the late 19th century, perhaps a little bit, you know, into the early 20th century as well. So they've been around for a long time. And one of the reasons they've been around for a long time is the second part of the response, which is that as disciplines get created and professional associations around them, you know, many of the early disciplines, for example, the American Historical Association in the US and I'm sure cognate institutions in the UK and other parts of the world, basically they were created at the same time. And these associations in the first instance became resources for faculty who were, you know, being trained in their graduate studies, moving to different universities, but then through these associations would stay in touch with each other. But, you know, as time goes on, you know, the logic of professionalization begins to take over. And increasingly what happens is that these associations become, in some sense, the silos that make up the university world. And so you have faculty who are effectively trained within a particular discipline, recommended for positions in faculty roles on the basis of, you know, the reputation of that department where they train. They get chosen by people in the same discipline. They often get evaluated then in terms of promotion on the basis of writing articles that are often in journals that are very specific to those disciplines. And then, you know, basically your entire professional life is dependent on working well within your own disciplinary lane. So all the incentives for faculty to maintain a kind of professional, to maintain a relationship with their professional identity and network, you know, are very, very powerful. And so it is often the case that when you talk to faculty, and I think the same is true in the UK as it is in the US, and I've been in a number of universities and it's true everywhere, that when faculty really begin to talk about where they are, they talk about their department. And, you know, I became aware of that, of course, when I was creating this joint PhD program. There was resistance from some members of both departments that, you know, we're basically, you know, we're going to lose control over this program because it's not going to be adjudicated entirely by and within the department. But these kinds of identities and loyalties and predispositions become even more visible when you begin to look at initiatives for change in a broader context across not just cognate departments in the humanities and social sciences, but as you were saying, across the entire arts and sciences. C.P. Snow, of course, you know, wrote the famous book on out of the lectures that he gave on the two cultures. But they really do that lecture and that that observation really does still characterize, I think, the fact that there are huge divides between the sciences and the arts. And that to a very large extent, in fact, there are multiple cultures in the university and many faculty live within those distinct subcultures. And they do often impede thinking more broadly about the university, thinking more broadly about curriculum, thinking more broadly about the kind of educational function of the university, and ultimately thinking more broadly about both how you teach, but also how you create new knowledge. And so you know, I've been thinking for some time that you know, we need to mix and match new kinds of structures in order to create different kinds of incentives for faculty in particular to to change the way in which they effectively adopt that kind of distinctive cultural association with particular disciplines. But it's hard. It's hard. And in the book, I talk about a few experiments that happened in the U.S. In which, institutions started without departments, and little by little, those units become departments because there's a kind of gravitational pull to the norm, which yields in the end much more uniformity than the founders of experimental kinds of institutions had themselves envisioned. But I think in an odd way today in the 21st century we're realizing anew that we need to try again, and we need to try again for a variety of reasons. We know, we were chatting before about the kind of difficulties that many humanities fields or humanistic social science fields have right now. Fewer and fewer jobs available, fewer and fewer majors or students reading in those subjects. And of course, people think that it's only because students want to go and study computer science so they can be assured of a job in a technology company. But it's also because we haven't necessarily changed the way in which we think about some of those fields, especially at the level of undergraduate training. And to the extent that we do that, we can do at least two things. One, we can probably get more students interested because it does reflect the world that students are not only living in, but are going to be graduating into. But secondly, it will, I think, be really, really important for the fields themselves. And artificial intelligence is a great example of that, because we now see how explosive the launching of GPT was just a little over a year ago, even as it's led to the development of all kinds of concerns about, what and how will AI, change the world we're living in? How will it change our notion of what it means to be human? How does it change the relationship between humans and machines? How does it change the nature of work? How will it change the workplace? How will it potentially be used in even more drastic scenarios that might involve autonomous weapon systems or other kinds of dangers associated with, or at least hypothesized for, AGI, artificial general intelligence, or the kind of specter of hell in Space Odyssey 2001, which is all to say that the humanities kinds of issues around meaning of life, the nature of the human, the character of society, our goals for our collective goals for social, political, economic goods of different kinds, are critical to the kinds of developments that are taking place today in science and technology. And we could talk about this in structural biology. We could talk about it in relationship to climate change. But in all of these things, it seems to me that there's a kind of overweening necessity for, for the philosophical, ethical, moral, social, et cetera, kinds of issues that we associate with these fields in the humanities and the social sciences and universities in the debates that are taking place in science and technology. So I think what would be good in some sense for universities in terms of rebalancing, or certainly restoring some of the importance of some of these fields that have been taking such a hit, is also clearly important, for the world that is outside the doors of the university, where we really need to be sure that the kind of intellectual mission of the university doesn't doesn't collapse in the face of these pressures to just train people for new technological kinds of jobs and careers.
Yeah, I think we not only have the issue of, faculty tying their whole identity to their department, and that making interdisciplinary work difficult, but also you mentioned, students themselves, I think, they see the value in pursuing maybe degrees that will get them a job after university, and they don't see really the value in the humanities and anything like that. They they want some investment. You know, they spend all this money to go to university and they want something at the end that will guarantee them a job and guarantee them something. So from the perspective of students, that's also a challenge, I guess, of how we rescue maybe the humanities, or you mentioned the liberal arts, you know, more broadly, you know, how that's not really valued anymore. But yeah, one challenge is also the students themselves, you know, what they want to pursue. And yeah, that's also a challenge. Yeah, and I also wanted to ask you, you know, you titled your book The City of Intellect, the uses and abuses of the university. And I think, you know, that using that term is also quite central to your whole book, City of Intellect, and how when we think of structural changes and reimagining new universities, how we need to think of them as cities of intellect. So I wonder if you could talk more about that idea or that term, because I think it's quite central to your vision of how we can make better new universities that, you know, do something different and deal with all the present challenges.
Right. Well, thank you. You know, I take the term from Clark Kerr, who was the first chancellor of UC Berkeley, and then he was president of the University of California system. He was also author of a book that came out of a set of lectures he gave while he was still president. The book is entitled The Uses of the University. So, you know, I kind of basically took a phrase that he used in that book and then the title of his book. But of course, I added "and abuses" along with the uses because, you know, I think things have changed, you know, and I have to be, you know, attentive to the fact that there really have been, you know, real issues about both how universities have continued to uphold the kind of missions that they were established with, but also the kinds of attacks that are taking place on the university from the outside. So I try to capture that in the title. But, you know, I also want to be clear that I don't want to be entirely just sort of nostalgic and say, you know, everything was fine back in the day. And, you know, now universities have lost their way and they just have to return, because I actually don't believe that at all. I think universities in some ways have gotten better and better and more connected to some aspects of social change that have been really critical for all of us. And to be clear, I mean, universities are much more diverse than they were 50 years ago when Kerr was in his roles. Universities have taken on in their curricula, but also in their mission, you know, all kinds of social and cultural projects that that reflect a new kind of commitment, not just to diversity, but to the social good in some sense. And I think you know, many of these changes have been for the good. And by the same token, even in the classes that we've taken on questions in a serious way around, you know, my own work on colonialism. But a lot of work on questions that that were not as much the focus of intellectual work in the 1950s and 60s as they've become today, you know, on race, on questions of gender and sexuality, and you know, that's just the beginning. And I have not only been part of these new movements within the university. I've supported and often championed them from the point of view of an administrator. But by the same token, I've seen universities take on more and more and more kinds of undertakings, and as they've done so, of course, the cost of higher education has grown enormously. And as the cost of higher education grows, and tuition fees, costs of attendance become greater and greater, even at the same time as students are, and you were just talking about this, increasingly worried about what kinds of jobs they're really going to be able to get at the end of this. Will they ever be able to pay back the debt that they incur as a result, and so on? There's been a growing contradiction, so that, you know, universities want to be more and more things to more people, but and they have been actively recruiting more diverse students, And students from more diverse backgrounds. But but at the same time, it's become more and more selective. Certainly the top universities, it's become more and more expensive. That's true both in top universities and other universities, since the costs seem to be incurred at every level. And of course, that then lowers access, and it reduces the kind of power that education can have to transform a life. If everybody has to just pay off their student loans for the next decades of their life, they're not going to be able to get on and do the things that they were thinking about doing. So of course that then further directs student attention towards doing something where they're going to get a job with an income where they can pay off their loans as fast as possible. So it becomes a kind of vicious cycle. And so in that context, I've come to believe that we really do need to find different ways to cut the costs, to share, of course, the burden to the extent possible. I spent a lot of my time at Berkeley trying to encourage the state to provide more funding for the university. Doesn't always work. Didn't work for me. I was up against a governor who was very clear. He believed in austerity. He was a liberal. In the American political system, but he still championed austerity. That's not always the case, as we know from, of course, UK politics. It tends to be the other way around. But that's the situation I confronted, and so I came, albeit reluctantly, to believe that we really do in universities have to begin to think, can we radically adjust the cost basis of what we do. And in asking that question, of course, everybody will agree in principle, but they won't necessarily agree as to how to go about it. And that's where, that's where the rub comes, because, we all think that all these new things that universities do are worthy. This is where I think, the kind of the need for faculty and administrative leaders to work together is more important than ever, because I think there are ways in which we can reconceive of what the function of the university is. And once we do that, we can begin to find ways to actually cut some of the costs. Now, again, I don't want to suggest that you should only cut costs in the ways in which it's been done. Too often, the way universities cut costs is they just hire adjunct teachers and instructors, and that both works to immiserate a new generation of recently graduated academics, but ultimately it kicks the can down the road for the institution, because it makes the tenured faculty into this tiny elite that is more and more cut off from the actual conditions of both the students that they're teaching, but also the colleagues that they're hiring from the world of PhDs. So,
I know all about that. Trust me.
Yeah, and I know you know a lot about that. And I don't want. That's why I didn't want this to be a story in which I'm kind of putting my head in the sand and saying, I just want things to be the way they used to be, and everything would be fine.
Mm-hmm. We don't in the UK, they're not called adjunct teachers, but obviously I think it's a different title. But yes, you see professors being hired on not a tenure track, and of course you have PhD students to just do the teaching, and you don't get like a proper contract or anything like that. And yeah, you wonder, where the university is spending all its money, and who are they paying? And you mentioned, that faculty and administrators need to work together to, to think about change. I think, I wonder if you could say something about administrators, because obviously there's this strong dislike sometimes for administrators. And well, you mentioned it in your book, that faculty themselves dislike administrators, but at the same time, they need them, both senior administrators and more low-level administrators, they need them. They depend on them because their faculty are so worried with their own careers, with their own, publishing, researching, you know, getting a better job and stuff like that, being promoted. But and they need administrators to deal with the students and, you know, or maybe even PhD students to do the teaching that they maybe do not want to do. But yeah, there's this, obviously this, dislike, you know, faculty dislike administrators. I don't know how much administrators dislike faculty. That's one challenge, isn't it? I guess, because to make them work together, something needs to change or, yeah, I wonder if you could say something about that.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, there is plenty of blame to go around. And I, you know, I want to be clear that I think that while there is blame to go around, there's also really the question of structure, which, among other things, structures incentives. And it even structures the way people view not just the world at large, but the university in particular. So you move into an administrative position and you see things from a different point of view. And faculty see things from the point of view of living in their departments. And it is certainly the case that when I was a member of faculty, some of the most important things that we worried about vis-a-vis the administration was, were they going to give us more lines in our department? Were we going to get more graduate student appointments and in our department? And oftentimes, was I going to get an FTE allocation, a full-time equivalent faculty allocation, in a field close to my own? And that was the kind of currency, as it were, of exchange and communication with the administration. You know, of course, you also relied on the administration to raise salaries or to, you know, provide research monies and things like that. But again, it was very much directed towards the question of, you know, what's in it for me? And me is not just the individual, but the circle within which one basically lives and works in the university, which is to say the department. So, you know, my thoughts about interdisciplinarity actually come back here, because I think that if you change structures, you not only change the outcomes in terms of, say, curricular development or the nature of program building, but you also change, you know, the kind of, dare I say, the kind of phenomenology of perspective on the university at large, and potentially begin to open up the vista a little bit. So I think these are all things that are going to be critical for multiple reasons, not least, though, for bringing faculty to the table with administrators. By the same token, you know, administrators often find themselves getting increasingly out of touch with the faculty. You know, they become professionalized too. The more they become professionalized, the more they can deal with, you know, the spreadsheets and budget issues and labor negotiations and so on and so forth that take place on the one side, and they have to do that. But on the more on the other side, they kind of lose touch, as it were, with what this really means for students and faculty and staff and others. I want to be very clear that that, you know, these questions of professionalization affect both sides of the equation. And yet we really need to figure out how to work together, because faculty are the core of the university, in the sense that they're the ones who are, you know, they make their careers there, they stay there. You know, students come, students go, faculty tend to stay. And they're the ones that are, you know, that are able to champion everything from academic freedom to the intellectual judgments and evaluations that need to be made about, you know, what is critical and what isn't critical in a field, and how it needs to change, and so on and so forth. And so one has to be able to tap into that. And if one doesn't, then, you know, you get this kind of, you know, this kind of divide between these two factions, and you sort of see an endless play of class struggle between faculty and administrators, which is, if I can use that term, which is not helpful. It's not helpful for, you know, figuring out what we have to do.
Yeah, and I think not only seeing the value in faculty, but yes, also in administrators, you know, and how they understand the university in very different ways than faculty do. And unfortunately, you get this isolated communities, you know, isolated faculty and isolated administrators that live in their own little bubble. And you talk about, in the last section of your book, you mention new experimental universities, you know, universities that are kind of popping up in the States that are trying something different, that are trying to be, just different, you know, from the model we're used to. I wonder if these universities are addressing some or most of the challenges we universities, you know, typical universities face today. And I wonder what your thoughts are on these new universities. Of course, I know you are you champion these new experiments and you are on the side of trying different things. and yeah, I are these new universities addressing some of the pressing issues? Some of them, most of them. What do you think of their future? Yeah.
Well, I do talk in the towards the end of the book, as you say, about a few of the new kinds of experiments that are taking place, and I've certainly been very much in favor of them. But the truth is, when I make that list, or when other people writing about this make those lists, there tend to be just a few names that come up, and then you run out of steam because there's not that much else to name. And so the real worry for me is that there are these kind of successful experiments, as Arizona State University is a large, conspicuous example of a place that has tried different ways to organize departments, to sponsor research, to think about even the mix between online and residential education. But it's just one model, one example. And in a way, it was able to be successful because it was when the current president went there over 20 years ago. It was a kind of third-tier sleepy university that nobody really cared about. So he was able to do a lot of change to it. And similar things could be said, for example, about Northeastern University, that it was, kind of sleepy commuter school that nobody paid attention to. And then it had a dynamic leader, and it made some really innovative changes. But another example I used is in Canada, Quest University, and it's had real struggles, and it hasn't been completely successful, even though it was really launched with great fanfare and enthusiasm. But the point is, there are not that many examples, and to a very large extent, we have all the crises that we know about taking place in the elite universities right now. Questions having to do with free speech and what is the nature of the curriculum, and dissatisfaction around students and student protest. But when you actually fan out and look at the second, third, fourth tier universities and colleges, you see there's much more local concern having to do with, are we going to be able to fill our class next year? The barriers for international students have made those numbers more intense too. So the truth is that there's a kind of real divide between what the top universities are confronting right now, which among other things, is never going to challenge the fact that they are going to be very attractive for people to apply to and try to go to. They're not going to have empty dorms anytime soon, unlike a lot of the other colleges and universities that are worried about that next year. So you often I think back to both the kind of period of growth of colleges and universities in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the U.S., and then to the period the post-war period in the 50s and 60s, where, for example, the University of California grew from, basically two campuses to nine or 10, depending on if you count UCSF. And And the that period of efflorescent growth, of course, is kind of over. So some of the most interesting experiments are taking place outside the U.S. and for that matter, outside the U.K., which is, you know, which had established its system of higher education even before the U.S. had. So so where is the dynamism taking place? And there's just not enough of it. And so even though I do give some examples of things I think are good models, I don't mean to suggest that that's a way of saying everything is fine, just the way it is.
Yeah, still champion these new colleges or new universities. But yes, they come with their own set of problems, made different to, you know, the ones facing big public universities and big, like, you know, famously renowned private universities as well. But I wonder if, you know, because universities are, you know, they face a lot of attacks in our present time. You know, you get this narrative from the right all the time, you know, that universities are just places where, you know, are woke, quote unquote woke, you know, full of left-leaning faculty, left-leaning students. Speech is stifled all the time. There's no real purpose to go to university because it's just full of these like Marxist people. But from the other side, you also get this narrative from the left, you know, that say universities are neoliberal, they're corporations, you know, they just want your money. And, you know, you get like this attacks from both sides of this political spectrum. And I wonder if there's a danger there of, some of these, you know, either a right-leaning person, individual, or like if they want to create their own universities, but, start a university from scratch or try and make their own model, but make it very politicized. Say, well, you know, yeah, I don't know if you can say something to that. I wonder if there's like a danger there of, creating universities, but not with the best, you know, not with this idea of the pursuit of truth and transfer of knowledge and all of the good things of a university, but with the idea of we're going to do something different, but because universities are, we want to make our own thing and make it very political and, yeah.
Well, there's a very conspicuous example of that in the U.S. right now, which is this new University of Austin.
I heard about it, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's proclaimed that it's going to be a free speech university, open to all intellectual viewpoints and a model of academic freedom. But then when you look at the people who are actually going there or being recruited there or, part of the initial committees that are establishing it, you realize it's a very specific group that feels disfranchised in relationship to, say, you know, some of the elite universities, some of whom, you know, were have their stories of having been, you know, drummed out of the university for the unpopularity of the views that they hold. And I'm sure that there are stories that they have that are that are compelling. But then what they are tending to do is create a very different kind of ideological litmus test to be part of this. So everybody basically has to have, you know, the notion that, you know, woke is bad in every possible way and so on. And, you know, that doesn't strike me as being the way you build a intellectually open, capacious, and genuinely free kind of setting for a university. Sure, there have been all kinds of issues that I think have demonstrated that academic freedom has to be very actively protected, even when it's not always popular. I think it's important to learn from some of the controversies that have taken place. What is effective and what isn't, and what is overreaction and what isn't. But the idea that, you know, you take a group of people who have been, offended, upset, cast out of, you know, of the normal university, and they're going to create this open space. I think that's a little bit preposterous. But that is not to say, and again, to go back to your larger framing of the question, it's not to say that there aren't things that, you know, critiques from even the right don't get right, because of course, you know, academic freedom is a core value, and on certainly public university campuses in the U.S., free speech is a necessity. I mean, it is the case that the First Amendment here applies to public universities, and so you really don't have a choice about whether or not in the public square of the university you're going to be able to have speakers from any point of view, whatever it might be, however outrageous that might seem to some other community. So, you know, that is very much the case. But, you know, I want to go back to even academic freedom, and I know that you know, these are sometimes nationally very specific kinds of discourses that develop. Academic freedom in the U.S. effectively dates back to 1915, when the fledgling American Association of University Professors put out a declaration of basic academic freedom principles, and they did so in large part because of a specific incident that took place at Stanford in 1905. When the president, at the urging of the major trustee, who was Mrs. Stanford, widow of Leland Stanford, basically was offended by the political comments of a faculty member, I think in the Department of Sociology, Edward Bross was his name, and that became a cause celeb. A number of people left, including Arthur Lovejoy, who wrote this book called The Great Chain of Being, who was part of the formation of the AAUP in the U.S. But, you know, at the same time that the declaration made it clear that academic freedom was a value, it effectively moved the adjudication and protection of academic freedom from the administration to the departmental or disciplinary basis of faculty life. So, you know, it had this interesting way of saying, you know, academic freedom will be determined by the profession, and you know, looked at from 107 years, 8 years later, 9 years later, here we are. It could be said that, you know, the time has come to kind of rethink perhaps how we frame academic freedom, because it probably needs to be thought about in broader terms than simply, you know, what a particular profession enacts as the kind of standard of relevance or controversy or whatever it might be. And all of these terms are used in subsequent statements and declarations by the AAUP. And by the same token, you know, even with respect to freedom of speech, the fact that the First Amendment applies to public universities and has been adopted by private universities is not in some sense a license to have, you know, some neo-Nazi come and teach a class at a university, as much as it is a way of saying there can be a public square in the university where people can talk about, you know, the kind of Hyde Park corner, as it were, of every campus, where people can talk about anything they want from any perspective they want. But it doesn't have to be everywhere in the university at all times. And it certainly doesn't need to be in the classroom. So there's a difference between what we mean by academic freedom and what we mean by freedom of speech, even as there's overlap, at the same time that I think there are ways in which all of these kinds of terms need to be specified in order to actually have not only meaning, but also to have, the capacity to not completely disrupt the university and its primary mission, which is to, you know, to produce new knowledge and then, disseminate that knowledge from to new generations of students and the like over time. So I think, you know, these are all complex issues. But right now, the political debate has really drowned out, you know, a lot of the sensible things that need to be done in order to restore the importance of these concepts.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think on that topic of free speech, it's a It's a difficult thing at the you know, because universities are, well, you kind of mentioned it previously. Universities right at the, you know, present time are very diverse. You know, you get a lot of international students, you get these different cultures, different religions, and it becomes difficult, you know, to hear certain types of speech and certain types of narratives. You know, they think maybe the potential offense is going to be more complicated, and you have to deal with a lot of sensitivities, you know, from people with very different backgrounds. So I think it's difficult. And in your book, you write about your experience with dealing with the invitation of Milo Yiannopoulos to Berkeley, and how that was a complicated thing to manage, you know, in your role. You know, I think, well, my impression, Milo is quite controversial, and he says some things that can be a bit you know, a bit out there. So yeah, I wonder, you know, when faced with inviting characters like that, you think about the safety of students, but also you need to make the compromise with, you know, you need to balance things out. And that happens, you know, all the time now. You know, you get people like Milo being invited to campuses, and students protest, they feel unsafe, they feel it's offensive, but then people, you know, people in your the role you had wonder, well, we need to protect free speech as well. But yeah, it's like you were saying as well, it's not like universities have this, make the decision of who to invite to campuses. It's not like you're gonna invite a neo-Nazi. You look at the person, you look who they are, why are we inviting them, right? What are we going to say? So yeah, I wonder if you could talk a bit more about what happened with the invitation of Milo, and how you handled the whole thing, and how you would connect that to similar things that have happened since.
Yeah, thank you. The case of Milo really did kind of bring up every one of the complex issues that you've just alluded to, and so, you know, it is kind of exemplary, I think, of the difficulties that come with the territory. So Milo was, you know, he was invited to come to the campus by a legitimate student group, the Berkeley Young Republicans. And quite honestly, they invited him for a very specific reason, because they knew they'd get a reaction. And they almost wanted there to be that kind of reaction that would allow them to say, yeah, this is Berkeley. You know, it's iconic for free speech, but actually it's not, because it's only, you know, speech on the far left that is protected. Speech on the far right is not protected. And so it really doesn't believe in free speech. So this was kind of a setup, right? And then it became a national test, as it were, of Berkeley's capacity to actually show the world that it was as committed to free speech as it seemed to suggest on its website and in all of our rhetorical proclamations, including when in 2014 we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the free speech movement as if it was something that was actually prosecuted by the administration. In fact, of course, the movement itself was against the administration, and ultimately, the chancellor who was involved in trying to, you know, tamp down the protest lost his job right away, and the president, who was Clark Kerr, who ultimately accepted the recommendations of the free speech movement, lost his job a few years later because he was fired by Ronald Reagan, who was a new governor of the state of California, and basically wanted to hold Kerr accountable for allowing all these protests not only to happen, but to, in some cases, succeed on campus. So, you know, we'd celebrated free speech and so on and so forth. And, you know, here comes Milo Yiannopoulos. Now, unfortunately, you know, first of all, Milo is deeply offensive. I mean, you know, I think he was a deliberate provocateur, and he was that way online. You know, he was kind of a troll, both online as well as in person. But unfortunately, of course, you know, the fact that he had been on this campus tour led to a number of other incidents. And there'd been a case at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee where a student had been outed. There was a case at Davis where there was a kind of riot around the protests on campus. And then there was a case where there was an actual shooting and injury on the campus of the University of Washington, all in the weeks ahead of his visit to Berkeley, that, you know, faculty and students alike would come to us and say, you really have to call this off. This is going to be horrible. But they would say, you know, it's going to cause me harm just by virtue of having him say these things on campus. And, you know, we would say, well, you don't have to go. In fact, you can not only not go, you could hold an alternate event. And, you know, you're not going to listen to these words. So they, you know, are they really going to be injurious just by virtue of the fact they're being said on campus, because they're being said off campus all the time? You know that. But then, you know, the same students and faculty would also say, and not incorrectly, that, you know, there would be the potential of actual physical harm taking place. And indeed, there was a riot. Thankfully, nobody was hurt, but there was extensive damage done to the student union, and even more damage done to the neighboring town of Berkeley, where, you know, banks, ATMs, and so on and so forth were smashed. A Starbucks was broken down. And in that instance, it was done so by a group that would have been seen roughly as being on the far left, a kind of group of Antifa. And so, you know, the whole event became this kind of exercise in both worrying about harm from speech, but also worrying about harm from actual, you know, physical actions that that kind of blended together and made it very difficult to disaggregate. And in the case of that particular visit, led to, you know, a kind of terrible result, because on the one hand, you know, the event didn't take place, even though we tried to have it take place, so we couldn't say we pulled it off. Milo claimed he was going to come back, and on the basis of that event, Ann Coulter said she was going to come to campus, and we had to begin to, you know, draw plans to spend, in the end, millions of dollars to keep the campus physically safe, even as we wanted to have one of these events take place just to show that we could do it. And yet, in which, of course, you know, there were many who felt that, you know, even the allowance of somebody like Milo, or for that matter, Ann Coulter or Ben Shapiro onto campus was a kind of abrogation of our fundamental duty to maintain the values of the university, which are values for diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, and the like as well. And so those all got, you know, put into this incredible mix of complexity. I think in the end, you know, what we learned from this experience was that you're never going to satisfy. I mean, if the right is going to critique you for being exclusive, you're never going to satisfy that far right group. On the one hand. On the other hand, there are members of the far left who fundamentally want you to make decisions about what is appropriate and what isn't, that are incompatible with the university as well, and that the university has to kind of re-articulate both its operational principles, but also its core values. And the core values, and this is what I allude to with the title of the book, City of Intellect, and this is what I really mean by it. The core values have to be around, you know, intellectual inquiry. Yeah. So we have to, on the one hand, insist that any, you know, any kind of outlook, any kind of view can be argued for and can be discussed and can be debated, and that indeed that is what the university is for. But on the other hand, that there have to be, you know, certain kinds of understandings and norms around what debate is, what disagreement is, what the freedom of inquiry requires, in order for it to be ultimately compatible with, you know, the kind of knowledge creation that is fundamental to the mission of the university. Easier said than done.
Yes, it's such a big problem. Even here in the UK, it's such a such a big thing, yes. A problem with free speech and feeling safe, and yes, it's a problem. We need to start wrapping up our conversation now, Nick, but I wonder, so maybe it's a last question, for people, for our listeners and anyone who reads your book, what would you say, or what would be the key takeaways or the things that you would want them to reflect on after they read your book?
Well, I think the most important takeaway is just that I think after accepting all the kinds of things that I talk about in the book, both doubtless missteps I made as an administrator, doing this as opposed to that or whatever, despite all the kinds of things that are claiming public attention and the headlines that circulate around the university. That there is something really, really critical to the role that universities play, and they're always going to make people a little uncomfortable. The outside world, along with open intellectual inquiry, is going to be the potential for people to be offended. But that the greater good is in fact really predicated on. Both opportunities for young people to take full advantage of the education available at the best universities in the world, and that knowledge is going to serve us well, and that you might be offended today, but in the long term, new knowledge, new ways of thinking about the world, new ways to both do things in the sciences and in technology, but new ways to even think about the meaning of what it is to be human in an age of machine intelligence. And these are really, really critical, and no other institution is going to replace the university. And I guess one further elaboration on that point, which is that at a time when there are demagogues who are taking over our politics in so many different parts of the world, universities still are repositories of more objective, more critical, more significant political, cultural, economic discourse than we find in our politics, and they are really important to protect. So yes, they have lots of problems. Yes, they have a lot of work to do, but boy, they're really, really important, and we need to try to protect and preserve even as we change them for the good of us all.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you for that, Nick. And yeah, I had thank you for this conversation today, and thank you for, carving out time in your I'm sure very busy schedule to talk to me today. And yeah, I will be linking a link to your book in the show notes so people can go and buy it if they're interested. So yeah, thank you so much.
And thank you for being a great interlocutor. It's really been a fun conversation.
I hope you enjoyed today's conversation with Nicholas Dirks on his new book, Seat of Intellect: The Uses and Abuses of the University. Thank you so much for listening. I am your host, Ariadna Obregon, here on the New Books on Higher Education podcast channel on the New Books Network. Have a great day.